All right. Hey, everybody. My name's Tom Pick, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, guys. Glad to be here tonight. I was asked a couple days ago to do this, and I've had such a cool experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that, I mean, one of my favorite things to do is to just run my mouth about it and share what I've gotten out of this deal. So I'm as thrilled as anybody to be here tonight. You know, my story isn't, you know, very much different than most people's in AA. There's a lot of things that haven't happened to me. I've never had a DWI. I've never been to prison. Never been divorced. I never lost a job, but that's not true. I lost one job back in 87. But there's a lot of things that I haven't experienced that a lot of people in AA have. On the other hand, I started drinking real young when I was 10 or 11 years old, and I was drinking on a daily basis at the age of 12, which doesn't by itself make me an alcoholic. But I say that to illustrate the fact that, you know, at a very, very early age, I was just unhappy. And yeah, there were some things going on in my life, parents divorced and that kind of stuff. But even if you disregard that stuff, like the book talks about, I was restless and irritable and discontent no matter how great things are going or how poorly things are going. That is my natural state. That's what I'm like without alcohol. You know, I'm kind of like that, like the dog in the middle of the floor that he circles up and he tries to find a little spot to sit down, and finally after about three or four loops around the carpet, he finds the right spot and he just drops and he's just perfectly happy. I never find my spot. I'm anxious, I'm bored, I'm always irritable. I always feel like I want to be doing something, but I got no idea what it is. I can't go to bed because I'm afraid I'll miss something. You kind of get what I mean? And so that's how I was without booze. Once I started drinking, all that stuff went away. And the reason I drank on a daily basis was because this spiritual malady that the book talks about was upon me every day, and it had to get fixed every day. And so that was my solution to my problem. When I drank, I don't know if I ever had control over my drinking. The book talks about how some of us, you know, we cross a line where we've lost control. I honestly don't remember having control. You know, I remember wishing that I could, you know, have three or four drinks, five drinks, maybe six drinks or seven, get really buzzed, and then stop. I always wanted to be able to do that, and I never could. And I never understood why. And for my first, you know, 17 years around AA, it was never explained to me. You guys talk about it in your preamble, about the physical allergy to alcohol, which Dr. Silkworth talks about in the doctor's opinion, you know, how that allergy presents itself in my case and any real alcoholic's case is it causes me to crave more alcohol when I put booze in my body. That's what it does for me. That's why when I try to get away with having six or seven drinks and getting really lit, I can't stop. I keep going and going and going and going until I either pass out or fall asleep or get arrested or, you know, something happens against my will that gets me to stop. Otherwise, you know, if I could stay awake, I'd probably poison myself with alcohol. I'd probably just drink myself to death. People have done it before, mostly fraternity guys, but, you know, those little lightweights. But I, you know, fortunately for me, that's never happened. So, you know, moving forward in time, I because of my drinking and because of, you know, the obvious problems that come along with it, not going to school, not getting along with my family, Major, major depression. No ambition, none of the stuff. I ended up in three separate psychiatric hospitals between the age of 14 and 18. And two of them were long-term places for 16 months each, and another one was for about 4 months up in Chicago where I grew up. And I can tell you those had to be the most miserable periods of my life, because I was removed from the booze, I was removed from my solution, and this spiritual malady just grew and grew and grew, and they're trying to treat it from a therapy angle, but what I've got is a spiritual problem that requires a spiritual solution, which I'll talk more about that in a few minutes. But I'm in these places, and the idea is that if I just talk about my feelings, if I just purge them, deal with my parents' divorce and my mother's drink and all these issues that they assigned to me, if I can just deal with this stuff and get it out and cry or whatever I'm supposed to do, everything's going to be okay. I'm not going to have to drink anymore. There's people, I've watched people for, you know, almost two decades in AA, the same people talking about the same problems for 10, 15, 20 years. And they're absolutely miserable. And they think that if they can just get their hands around this stuff and resolve it, whatever that means, they won't have to drink anymore. Because what we do in our meetings, and I don't know about this group, but I know in the groups I was going to, the message we send is, hey, you got a problem, bring it to the meeting, we'll help you fix it so you don't have to drink over it. And the truth is that we don't drink over that stuff. You know, this deal is, it's a genetic thing. The number that they throw around is, you know, 1 in 10 of us caught the magic bullet and we're predisposed to this thing. There's millions of people who've had much worse lives than I have. You know, horrendous childhoods, abuse, rape, incest, I mean, you name it. They've gone through this stuff and it didn't turn them into alcoholics. So why are we going to take our issues and blame our alcoholism on that stuff? It just doesn't make sense to me. Now, when I was sitting in the middle of these discussion meetings, it made all the sense in the world, because, you know, I started going to these meetings and that pretty much became the doctrine. When you hear this stuff over and over and over, you start to think that this is the way things are supposed to be. You know, like a lot of folks, I came to AA through a treatment center. I had to go back to Chicago. I was living in Austin at the time, and I was 22 years old, and things were just crazy out of control. And I called my dad, asked him to send me a plane ticket, because I wanted to go up and hang out with Dad and, you know, kind of buddy up with him for a while and spend some quality time with him, and hadn't seen him in a while, and he wouldn't have any part of that. He told me, you know, look, I'll bring you up here, but you're going straight from O'Hare, the airport, to this treatment center in a little suburb north of Chicago. And after I thought about it a little bit, by the way, the cops are knocking on my door at this time. That's what got me to call Dad to see if I could come up to Chicago. But it was some chicken shit thing they were knocking over, and they ended up going away. But I was like, okay, Dad, I'll take this deal. I'll go, because I thought they'd come back. So I went, and I went and got treated, and came back to Austin. I had, got out on my 23rd birthday, and I had, I don't know, 28, 29 days, something like that. And I started following the directions they gave me. They told me to, you know, go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and get a sponsor, and do all sorts of stuff. So I was like, okay, I'm in. I went down and went to my first meeting the night I got out. And I got there, and man, these are the coolest people in the world. I mean, they all came up, introduced themselves, kind of a younger crowd, lots of pretty girls. And I liked these people. And I started going to their meetings, and I started doing that 90 meetings in 90 days. The problem was is by the time I got there, I wasn't feeling any of the pain from when I was drinking. any motivation that I would have had to have taken the steps was which is gone by the time I got out and started going to the meetings. And so, yeah, you know, I knew it might be a good idea to do the steps because I heard people talking about them. We put them on the walls, and but I didn't understand what they were about. I thought that they were about, you know, turning Tom into a good boy. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm not drinking. And all that bad stuff that was happening when I drank, it quit happening. I'm a good boy. So I didn't really see the dire need to do this stuff. And so I didn't. I kind of dragged my heels and did little vain attempts at the steps. I had some sponsors that I thought were good sponsors, and they were great people. But the problem was is that we didn't have any direction on how to do this program in our meetings. We weren't bringing the big book to the meetings. We weren't talking about God and the steps. In fact, we didn't make a conscious effort to not talk about God, but it didn't come up that much. We didn't want to freak out any new people or make them think it was some kind of religious thing or something like that. Well, you know, think about this. Our only solution is God. Why in the hell wouldn't we talk about God in our meetings? That's the only thing that can fix this deal. We weren't doing that. We weren't talking about God in the steps. What we were talking about is our day and our problems and our issues and our past traumas and you name it, man. I mean, you know, it was discussion hell. And after a couple of years, this stuff, I mean, it just started to grind on me. And after about 5 years, I'm starting to resent the people that are participating in these meetings because I'm hearing the same things over and over. And it's just, it's getting boring. It's getting extremely boring. By that time, I had heard every slogan, every bumper sticker, every saying, and even three or four lines quoted out of the bid book. I mean, I had heard it all, and there was nothing fresh. And so I'm just stuck in these meetings. I'm afraid to leave the meetings because I was taught that if, you know, that the people that quit coming drink. So I'm thinking, well, okay, I can come. I mean, I got time. I'll show up. You know, what the hell? And so that became my doctrine. And we started, you know, training each other to think through the drink and as if, you know, remembering how bad it was when I finished drinking is going to scare me into taking the first drink. Man, when I think through the drink, I drink. You know, my mind takes me back to that sense of ease and comfort that Dr. Silkworth talks about that comes at once by taking a few drinks. You know, so I moved to Dallas from Austin in 98, and I remember being here for a few years. I think I had about 15 years, and I'm sitting in this meeting. It's a men's meeting. It's a discussion meeting on Saturday mornings, and these guys are just, they're just killing me. On one hand, I really love them because I've spent, you know, 300 Saturdays with them, but on the other hand, I am so freaking tired of hearing about Mike's cat dying and Kelly's divorce and Joe's job problems and all this stuff. I've just absolutely had it. And we're going around in a circle, and the chairman picks some topic. I don't know what it was. Doesn't matter. But he starts calling on people, and the topic keeps changing every time he calls on somebody because everybody's talking about themselves, and so the topic will change. It gets to me. And I'm not prepared. I hadn't been sitting there working on my act. I had no idea what to say because I wasn't into the meeting. I wasn't preparing what I was going to say in the event that I got called on. So I paused for a minute. I said, you know, my name's Tom. I'm an alcoholic. And they all said, hi, Tom. And I said, look, man, I don't want to scare any new people in this room, but I feel like I'm going to drink again. And I don't think it's going to be today or tomorrow or this week, maybe not even this month, and maybe not even this year. But I'm on a path where I'm going to drink again, and I can't derail this thing. And they all said, you know, we love you. And then they kind of shared at me for the rest of the meeting. And then they came up to me and gave me hugs afterwards and gave me advice like, you know, come early, make the coffee, set up chairs, double up in my meetings. And I'm just thinking, if setting up chairs and making coffee and doubling up on meetings is my answer, I'm freaking dead. I ain't going to make it. And 2 years later, I didn't. All those things that I'd bet my life on, meeting attendance and thinking through the drink and the laurels that I had accomplished at one time by doing treatment center meetings and other stuff, all that stuff that I was betting my life on quit working. The mental defense that I had to have didn't stop me. And before I drank, I had a dialogue with myself. You know, it wasn't like, you know, Jim's story where suddenly the thought, you know, maybe the thought came into my mind suddenly, but I had time to have a dialogue with myself. And I remember telling myself, buddy, don't do this. You're going to lose your sobriety date. You could lose your family, your kid, your business, your life, your friends, all this stuff. You could lose all this stuff. Don't do it. And by then it was just too late. I couldn't talk myself out of this. And I drank again. And I was unbelievably freaked out. I thought that by, you know, high meeting attendance and thinking through the drink and using my head and being used to not drinking, you know, kind of being in the habit of not drinking, I thought all that stuff would save my bacon, and it didn't. And it scared the crap out of me. And, you know, I would guess that I'd probably been to 5,000 meetings at this point. I mean, I wasn't one of these guys that just drops in, you know, once a month or just to get a, you know, a birthday chip. I mean, I was there. And I was going to the meetings. And even after I started drinking, I was going to the meetings. And I don't recommend this. I mean, if you're not happy in discussion meetings, don't drink and go to them. But they ain't so bad when you got a little buzz. You can feel a little love for some of these people that you've been resenting for years. Long story short, I crashed and burned, and I ended up in this little treatment center down in Kerrville, and I ran into this guy who just banged on the big book. And I sat down and listened to his big book lecture, and I'm just, it's 95 degrees outside, and I'm freezing, man. I've got on scrubs and two blankets and two pairs of socks, and I mean, I'm in bad shape, and I'm full of phenobarbital, and my speech is all screwed up, and my hands are shaking. I can't even write anything. And I sit down, and I'm listening to this guy read to me out of the big book, and he's teaching me what step one means. And man, that guy's got my ear. He's saying stuff out of the big book that I'd never heard before in my life. 5,000 meetings, I never heard this stuff before. And he's got my ear, and I'm listening to this stuff. And all I'm thinking is, oh man, when my eyes start working again, I'm going to get my hands on the big book and see what this guy's talking about. Because I have got to see this for myself. And we had this meeting every morning at 8 o'clock. And I, you know, I did that meeting with him for, you know, 37 days. I listened to him talk about my truth, my real problem out of this book and the real solution. See, the deal is, like most people that come to AA at any group at random, the message I got was that step one means I've got a drinking problem, and the unmanageability is all the goofy stuff that happens when I drink. All the bad stuff that happens. DWIs, bad checks, losing relationships, getting arrested. I mean, you guys know the drill. All the bad stuff that happens when we drink is what I was taught was the unmanageability. Well, I had stopped drinking. And the alleged unmanageability stopped happening. As far as I'm concerned, my problem solved. All I need to do is coast, go to some meetings, do some meetings at some treatment centers, you know, tell my story, try to, you know, tell some funny war stories, make them laugh and all this garbage, and everything's going to be groovy. What Chris is telling me down, reading out of this big book, he's talking about the physical allergy, the mental obsession, and the spiritual malady that gets the whole ball rolling. And he's reading out of the doctor's opinion, and he's talking about this allergy. And when he's talking about an allergy, he's not talking about, you know, hives or a rash or your throat swelling up from penicillin. All an allergy is an abnormal reaction to something. We react differently than most people to something. I'm cool with penicillin. I can take it all day long. Most people are, but some people, they have a reaction where their throat closes up and they could die. They could literally die from taking penicillin. These same people, when they come to my house, I do not have to lock up the penicillin afraid that they're going to get in there and just take the whole bottle. So the way our allergy manifests itself, presents itself, is in the form of a craving where I talked about earlier. When I put booze in my body, I crave more booze. Dr. Silkworth, in The Doctor's Opinion, talks about this in this paragraph on Roman 28. He says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. He says, the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Normal drinkers do not experience the allergy. You know what happens to them when they drink? It makes them sick. They start to feel it. They start to feel out of control. You know what they do when that happens? They stop. They don't like feeling out of control. They don't like feeling sick. Not so with us. With the real alcoholic, if you're a real alcoholic, you experience this. Says they can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And our bodies can't tell what's on the label. It doesn't matter if it's NyQuil, Listerine, God only knows what some of you guys have drank. Our bodies react to the alcohol. That's what we react to. Says once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human. I thought humans were going to save me. I thought psychiatrists, if I just get to the right psychiatrist, get the right antidepressant, talk about the right issues, cry the right amount of times, whatever, I'll finally be okay. And that day never came. No preacher, no spouse, no girlfriend, no parent, no human ever relieved us of our alcoholism. It never happened. Hard drinkers? Perhaps. We'll talk about that in a minute. Then it says their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Well, no kidding. Bottom of the page. Here's why we drink. This really kind of smashes to hell what I'm guilty of teaching people, new people in AA, where they've got to deal with their issues. What he's saying here is that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I was talking about alcoholic men and women. Says the sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, and those injuries include things like going to treatment, going to jail, losing your job, spending all your money, whatever, those are the injuries that they're talking about. They cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. It says to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Here's one of the big lines in the book. It says they are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. He's talking about the spiritual malady. This is what it looks like. You know, you can also turn to 52 or 53, I forget what page it's on. It goes more into the spiritual malady. But basically he's telling us that without booze, we're just naturally miserable, and our only solution to the spiritual problem is the booze. And for a while, I got to tell you, man, it worked perfectly. I'm not stupid. I didn't drink this stuff and have all these problems because it wasn't doing something for me. the benefit outweighed the cost until it switched. And then it turned out, at least for me, where I didn't want to keep drinking and I didn't want to stop drinking. And that was just a hell of a spot to be in. Thank God there were some other outside issues I could avail myself of to keep the game going a little bit longer. But, you know, finally I was brought to my knees and I got help. If our problem were just a physical problem, the answer would be, don't drink. If you don't drink alcohol, you cannot crave it. Period. Can't happen. You got to put it in your body to crave it. Once it's out for, 72 hours, 96 hours, not long. Once it's out of your system, the physical craving is gone. What are you left with, though? I know what I was left with. An unbelievable obsession, where my mind kept going right back to that sense of ease and comfort that Dr. Silkworth talks about. My mind can't think through the drink. All it can think about is how good it made me feel, how it fixed all my spiritual problems. You know, for some people, they can last a while. I'm good for about 12 hours before I'm ready to drink again. Think about the worst day of your drinking. The day that the very worst thing that ever happened to you happened. I don't know about you guys, I swore off drinking. And when I swore it off, I meant it. And when I told my girlfriend about it, I was 110% committed. 8 hours later, maybe, I'm drinking again. I was able to remember that period, 8, 12, 16 hours ago, well enough to keep me from picking up a drink until later that evening. You know, at 2 in the afternoon, there was no way in hell I was ever going to drink again. 4 in the afternoon, no way. 8 o'clock at night or 9 o'clock, whenever it was, way. I'm drinking. And that's what I did. You know, another thing that this buddy of mine down in Kerrville explained to me was about the mental obsession. And once in a while, those words would come up in a meeting, but it just didn't have a whole lot of meaning to me, because when I heard it, I wasn't experiencing any thoughts of drinking. After quite a while, the obsession had been removed, and I wasn't, you know, my mind wasn't on drinking. But when he starts reading this stuff to me out of the big book and explaining the second half of step one, the unmanageability, and telling me what that is, that's when all the dots got connected. You know, see, I was going to lots and lots of meetings, and we had all sorts of little dots all over the meetings, but they were never lined up to where anybody could connect them. It was just personal opinion here, speculation here, no experience, but I'm going to talk about the steps anyway over here. All sorts of stuff, and I could never, you know, put two and two together until Chris read this deal. And at the top of page 24, it says, at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. Makes sense. It says, this tragic situation has arrived in practically every case long before it has disappeared, long before it is suspected. And then there's some italic writing in it. If you guys don't have this underlined in your big books, go home and do it, man. This is one of the most important paragraphs in the whole book. It's the one that saved my life. It says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. It says, our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. Says, we are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. What this is saying is, it's saying, even though I can remember everything that happened, some of it's cloudier than other times, but I can remember all the bad stuff that happened, I can't remember it with sufficient force to keep me from that first drink. What I'd been hearing in AA for almost two decades was bad information. What I'd been telling people to do in AA for almost two decades was terrible information. I was teaching them, like I was taught, to rely on my mind to keep me sober. That if I can just stay focused on that last drink and what it was like, that'll be enough. That and going to meetings and making coffee. So what they're telling us in this book is in complete conflict with the rhetoric that we hear in our meetings. And trust me, I mean, I am a card-carrying member of the Middle of the Road Solution Seekers Club. I mean, for 17 years, I thought I had found the bare minimum that it took, and I was focused right on that. And I'd hear us, you know, we'd talk in our preamble about, you know, how half measure to build is nothing, and I'd think, oh, bullshit. You know, you can do that when you're sitting there 13, 14, 15 years knowing that what you're doing isn't even half measures and you're still sober. See, I'm thinking that you know, I've got this stuff figured out. The truth was I had no idea what my problem was. I had no idea that my mind couldn't keep me from the first drink. And I had no idea that it was my body that couldn't keep me from the second drink. That's an absolute death sentence. There is no hope in step one at all, period. With this knowledge, I found the motivation to take the rest of the steps. I understood the death sentence. I understood how dire it was to treat this deal, how lethal and deadly my situation is. You know, now, a week prior to hearing this stuff, I'd been on two different ambulance rides where they're, you know, trying to keep me alive and stuff, and I'm not going to go into those stories, but I'm pretty in touch with how deadly this thing is and how dangerous it is. So when I finally understand exactly what the problem was, I'm pretty motivated to take these steps. And the people that we're sponsoring, I don't know about any of you guys sponsoring people, but I find that when I explain this stuff to people, it's not that hard to get them to take these steps. When you explain to them that it's the spiritual malady, it's a spiritual problem that kicks off the obsession, that once you start drinking, it triggers the craving, and it's just a vicious cycle, and there's no end to it. When they can really appreciate that information, and that the only solution is taking the steps, they'll do it. They will do it. I remember, is there anybody here that disagrees that our success rate isn't that great? In fact, it's so bad, we ought to call it a failure rate. Dallas, Texas, based on chip sales, it's not scientific, but it's an indication of where we're at. You know, according to our chip sales, you got up 5-7, I'll be generous and say 10% chance of making it a year. You got 25% chance of making it 90 days. All those people that we tell to go to 90 and 90, we tell 100, 25 are there to pick up their chip. I don't know what happens on the 91st day, but I've told them to do it too. I am just as guilty as anybody of giving that direction. Because I didn't know anything about this book. I didn't know about the steps. I just did what was done to me, and I'm trying to pass this information on to people. But the deal is back in the 30s, what these guys were doing was they weren't setting up meetings and trying to have four or five meetings a day so that anybody who needed a meeting any time of day or night could have a meeting to stay sober. That's not what they were doing. What they were doing is they were praying, meditating, keeping their side of the street clean, and looking for people to work with, actively looking for them, going to hospitals, you know, cold calling doctors and priests, hey, you guys got anybody we can talk to? They were busting their butts looking for people to work with. That's what their life was like back in the early 30s, back when 50% to 3/4 of them were getting sober and staying sober. The people that really did this work and honestly did it, they were staying sober, every last bit of them. The problem is today we've gotten to a point to where we've gotten away from the big book and we've flip-flopped into putting emphasis on the meetings and the fellowship instead of the program. It was the softer, easier way. I had no problem with how we were doing things once upon a time. Today I got a big problem with it. I almost lost my life in this deal, and I've watched countless others go back out and drink and die, you know, since 87, since I've been around. People who wanted the solution, who came for the solution, and we didn't have it for them. And I find that disturbing. And I'm gonna share some of my experience and some of my observations with you guys, and this is where I'm gonna close the warm, touchy feely part of the talk. And I understand that some of the things I might say might make someone in here feel uncomfortable. I don't know who it is, and it might be nobody, but I know for damn sure it would have made me uncomfortable when I was sitting around in AA, taking up space, doing nothing, being a total bogart, trying to get as much as I could instead of giving. But it's my experience, and it's what I've observed, and it's what I've done. If you go to page 62, Bill Wilson tells us what the root of our troubles are. It talks about the selfishness, the self-centeredness. We've all heard it. I even heard this stuff in meetings. Every once in a while this would kind of slip in there, and we'd talk about it a little bit. We didn't know what we were talking about, but we'd talk about it. It says, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows, and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise about ourselves. The alcohol is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though we usually don't think so. It says, above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of the selfishness. There's one of the musts that we don't have in the program. Here comes another one. We must, or it kills us. Not only do they tell us that we must be rid of it, it tells us why. We've got to get rid of this, or it kills us. What happens is it blocks us from God, which is the only thing that can save our bacon in terms of keeping us free from the obsession to drink and treating that spiritual malady. So that's how it kills us. If we're wrapped up in self, we're never going to get plugged into that power that we have to have to stay sober. When I'm thinking about me, there's no possible way I'm thinking about anybody else. And the only time I'm aligned with God's will is when my thoughts are on other people and God and what I can do for them and for Him. When I think about what I can do for myself, I'm in big-ass trouble. Big trouble. So, we had our meetings. We had our discussion meetings. We had lots of them. 35 a week, 34 a week, something like that. Just crazy. And it's what it turns into is 34 opportunities to come in and talk about yourself. And if we love each other so much, and knowing that this selfishness can kill us, why do we allow people to come in the meetings and engage in that selfishness and talk about themselves and let it go on and on and on? These people, you know, I don't want to take anybody's inventory, but hell, I mean, it's right out there. They're selfish. They're wrapped up in this stuff. They're not recovered. And we've got a responsibility, if we love these people, to pull them aside and say, hey, man, you know, what I'm hearing is you can't think about much besides yourself. Let's go do step 10. Let's take the steps. Let's do something. Let's get you out of yourself instead of instead of just letting them rattle on and on. Because the guys that have been there for a number of years are just, you're driving us crazy. And the new people, and we don't know this, we don't, because the new people don't tell us. I hear it at the treatment centers that I go to. The new people are disgusted by it. They're disgusted by it. It makes them not want to come back. It makes them sick. It makes them critical. And, you know, all these guys are looking for a reason not to come back anyway, and we hand it to them. I'm telling you guys, take my word for it, or don't take my word for it. Come with me to some of these treatment centers and talk to these people who have had years or months or several periods of 1 year. I mean, I see it twice a week, and they're all saying the same thing. They can't stand the meetings. And you know what? I had a friend. We worked together before I got sober, and I had about 5 years, and he called me up, and I finally got the call. He's like, man, I'm ready to stop. I said, fantastic. I've been hoping to hear from you. He says, are you still sober? I'm like, yeah. He says, well, man, let's go to one of those meetings. I was like, great. So I take him to a meeting. We get in the car and we leave, and he's like, Pat, what was that? I'm like, what do you mean? What was that that we just went to? I mean, I know it was an AA meeting, but is that what they're all like? And I'm like, well, yeah, why? What's the matter? He says, well, all they're doing is just pissing and moaning and shit, I can't keep doing that. And I'm like, dude, you don't get it. You know, that's your solution. You know, you're just being critical because you probably still want to drink, and so you're trying to find a reason not to go. Well, you know, I got news for you. That's, you know, bad news is that's how it is. The good news is, you know, it works. And so we went to a couple more meetings, and then he went to a meeting on his own, and he called me when he got home, and he's pissed. I mean, he's had it. And he's like, dude, I can't hang with this anymore. There's got to be something else. I'm like, I'm not aware of anything. And he says, well, screw it. I can't deal with that stuff. It's just silly. I was like, well, man, I think you're making a big mistake. And a week later, he wrote a suicide note and killed himself. And there's some who may say that he didn't want it bad enough. I'll submit to you that he wanted it plenty bad. But when he showed up, it wasn't there for him. Because we were so busy talking about ourselves and wrapped up in ourselves and violating the traditions by permitting people to talk about outside issues in our meetings, that when the time came to carry this message, we were too busy doing something else. And a guy like me, I had no idea that what we were doing was killing these people. I really didn't. I thought that it was just kind of, it just kind of made sense that only, you know, 5 or 10% of the people made it. I had no idea that back in the day, back when these guys were working the steps in just a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, that they were getting sober. I had no idea. When I first heard of this stuff about working the steps in a week or two, that blew my mind. You know, I, like most of you guys, I've heard all sorts of direction on when to take the steps. The one I liked was a step a year. You know, well, you can't do step four until you've had a year because you can't handle what's going to come out on your inventory. The people that tell you that don't know what the inventory is about. Because I got news for you. You can handle it. If you understand steps 1, 2, and 3, you've got enough juice from God. You got enough of God's power to get through that fourth step and get through that fifth step, and it snowballs and it builds to get you through the rest of the steps. I had no idea. I remember telling people that they can't sponsor anybody till they've got a year. Think about it. Our solution is step 12, carrying this message. If you got a problem like on page 24, where we got maybe a week or a month that we're going to be able to think through the drink till it doesn't work anymore, we got a week or a month to get to the solution or we're screwed. Why would we keep somebody from the solution working with others by telling them to wait a year. That's it's crazy. It's a death sentence. These people don't need to be waiting for a year. If you've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, you got what it takes to carry this message. In fact, maybe even more effectively than anybody with 5 or 10 years does, because that new guy is going to listen to a guy with 30 days, you know, who 30 days ago was doing what he was doing, and now he's not, and he's experienced the promises in the book. There's nobody better that could do that for that guy. This time around, I took the steps in, I don't know, 9, 10 days, 11 days, something like that. And I was sponsoring my first guy with 3 weeks. And then I was going down to the Salvation Army every Wednesday night, and it never failed. Each night I picked up at least 2 guys to work with. Now, they had to have sponsors, but I was sitting down there till 10 o'clock at night every Wednesday night, taking the steps with these guys in this nasty hallway on this tile floor with lots of loud noises and cinder block walls and all this stuff. And we're down there, and we're taking these steps. And these guys are doing their inventories. And we're hitting our knees all together doing the third step prayer. And it's the coolest thing in the world. I wouldn't be here today if I hadn't done this stuff. I really wouldn't. I've got a new guy right now who just finished the steps less than a month ago, who's just knocked on dead at the Salvation Army every Wednesday. It's the coolest thing in the world. The problem is getting people focused on the steps and on the program and getting them through them quick enough so they don't get ruined by anything that they might hear in some meeting about how they can take their time with the steps. You know, if you've got me telling someone you got to take the steps in less than 2 weeks like they did back in the 30s, and you got some other guy telling you to take your time, where are you going to go? I know where I'm going. Hell yeah. I'm going with that other guy. So, I know I don't have to come out and say this, but I think discussion meetings are just the worst thing that ever happened to AA. I do, and right after noon meetings. Because they lend themselves to an environment where things can get out of control. Nobody likes to cut somebody off when they're talking, when they're spilling their guts, even though it's not appropriate for the meeting. We don't have a right to say whatever we want in the meeting. Our primary purpose is to carry this message. If we're not talking about God or the steps, we need to be quiet. We need to go work the steps so we got something to say in that meeting. But they lend themselves to this stuff, and you know, I wish that, you know, I started off going to big book studies. The group I go to now, and there's no ego in this thing. I wish I had something to do with this group, but I don't. This group was up and running for 18 years just fine without me. I just happened to get lucky enough to find it. And I hooked up with a guy who understands the steps and he understands the big book, and he took me through the work and he threw me into carrying the message to others at detox centers and the Sally and some other places, speaking at other groups. I had like, I don't know, 4 months when I spoke at my first group here in town. Scary stuff, but once I did it, when I've got a message to carry, it's not that hard. All you got to do is just open up the big book and read it a little bit. Nobody knows the difference. But what I saw in this group was different than anything I'd ever seen before in my life. I finally saw a group where the emphasis was on carrying this message, where if I were to go in there and try to talk about myself, I would have 150 people lean forward in their chairs and shut me down. Not just look at me and hope that I'd shut up, but they would speak up and say something, and they would get it right back on track to the book study. What we do there is we carry, I don't know the number, it's over 30 meetings to wind-up joints, jitter joints around town, treatment centers, jails, hospitals. As you know, as members of our group, we do this stuff. We meet 3 times a week, 150 people on Tuesday nights, sometimes more, but usually about 150 people, studying the big book here in Dallas, Texas. Who would have thought? We could. I'm sure we could pack the house every night, but we don't. We meet Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays because we don't want people camping out in the meetings. the meetings aren't the solution. I mean, if you didn't get that from my story, the meetings are not the solution. The meetings are a wonderful place to hook up, talk about the program of recovery out of the book, and find new people to work with. Great for that. I recommend you go. But if you're going to a meeting because you need to get something out of it, you've missed the whole thing. It's for me, doing this program for so long without working the program and doing the deal, it was like going to an orgy and not having sex. It was, you know, I was just right there, and for some reason I refused to take my clothes off and join in. And I was like that for 17 years. And it's funny, now that I'm in the orgy, I run into people all the time who criticize our group and people that talk about the Big Book. You know, that's just some, you know, AA Nazi or some Big Book thumper. While those guys are standing out there looking in the window of the orgy, I got news for you. We don't hear the complaints. We're in there having sex. And there's room for everybody. We don't want this separation. We just want to get back to doing what they were doing back in the 30s when this thing worked so damn well, when it worked beautifully. I'm going to finish with a little story that happened to me while working in the Salvation Army a while back. Or not working there, but taking a meeting there. Finally, after, you know, almost 20 years in this deal, I finally feel like I'm doing my part in AA. I don't feel like a deadwood anymore, being a Bogart. And I finally understand what the message is, and I understand exactly what to carry, and I've got no problem taking anybody through the steps. I'm not afraid to do that stuff because I've got experience, I've got this book to back me up. Prior to that, scared the hell out of me because I really didn't know what I was doing. So I'm at the meeting, and these guys are all, they're coming out of a prison program, and then they have to do 90 days at this alley and go through their program. And then, you know, they can get paroled or leave or whatever. And there's this guy, and he comes up to me, and this guy is freaking huge. 6'3", 6'4", probably about 300 pounds. A little fat, but not very. Large black man. If he makes a fist, it can cover my whole face. And he comes up to me and says, "Sir, will you be my sponsor?" And he starts talking to me. He's like, he says, "You know, there have been 5 other groups that have brought meetings in here, and I've asked a bunch of people at every one of those groups to be my sponsor, and nobody will do it." He says, I've been in and out of prison for 27 years, and if I go back, I'm going for life. Can you help me?" Now, the first thought I had was, well, you can't tell people that you've done 27 years in prison and ask them to sponsor you. That's like the worst sales pitch I've ever heard in my life. My next thought is, I can't believe that none of those people would help this guy. Either they didn't know how to do it, which is fine. If you don't know how to sponsor somebody, if you haven't taken the steps, had a spiritual awakening, and someone asks you to sponsor them, say no. It's okay to say no in AA. Say no to that. But if you have, you say yes. And so I don't know if these people just didn't know what to do, or if they were too afraid of this guy, or if they were too lazy, or I don't know what the deal was. But I said, "Hell yeah, come on back." And I pulled him out of the meeting. We do a meeting from 8 to 9. I took him right down the hall, and we got started on this stuff. And I started talking about step one and reading out of the doctor's opinion and out of the first part of the book and talking about the physical allergy, the mental obsession. He's not quite getting it. And I said, "Well, let me ask you a question. You're going to go back to prison for the rest of your life if you get jammed up again." And he says, "Yeah." I said, "Do you think that knowing that that'll happen, that that'll keep you sober?" And he's like, "No." I said, "Buddy, that is the unmanageability. That's what we're talking about. and his eyes get real big. He finally understands what his problem is. And we go through step two pretty quick. He's cool with the God thing. He believes God can help him. And we get on our knees. And I explain to him, you know, what step three means. You know, if you look at the words of step three, you'll see real clearly, we're making a deal with God. You take away my difficulties, this is what I'll do. You do this, this is what I'll do. And basically, we're telling God, hey, man, you take care of us, and I'll go tell everybody about it. I'll bear witness to what you did. And I'll go work with others. That's the deal we're making. So if you've taken step three, you owe God. You got a debit to God. But so we get on our knees, and I said, okay, let's read this out of the book. Take my hand. We're gonna read the prayer together, and we're gonna say it together. Then I want you to say it over in your own words, and I want to hear what you're saying to God. So we go through it, and then I said, okay, now put in your own words. And this guy starts talking, and he's got my little baby hand in his huge hand, and he's squeezing it like crazy, and he's pulling it into his chest. We're both on our knees on the tile floor at the Salvation Army, and he's talking to God, and it's just the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And this guy, in no uncertain terms, offered every part of him to God and told God exactly what he would do in exchange for that. And this guy, he's got tears coming down his face. My hand is right there. My hand is soaking wet from this guy's tears. And man, I'm not keeping it together. And I've got tears going down my face. And he finishes, and I just looked at him, and I was like, man, that was so cool. I got no idea what to say right now. I got no idea. But thank you for letting me in on that. This is the cool stuff that happens when we take these steps and we carry this message. There's plenty of other stories like that. Every guy I work with, we get on our knees and I'll listen to what he's saying to God. This is the most personal thing that anybody can do, and I get to see that and witness it right in front of my eyes. And I get to see these people change in a week or 2 weeks, and I see them catch fire. I used to think that sponsoring people was such a big chore because I'm going to get all sorts of phone calls with all their problems. You know what happens if you make the commitment with these guys in the front end and do the steps like it says to do in the big book, exactly like they're directed and as quickly as it says to do it? I don't get these phone calls. These guys are doing fine. They do a 10-step call if they're fearful or frightened or selfish or whatever. They call me up. Hey, man, this is a 10-step call. All right, what'd you do? We'll go ask God to remove it and go turn your attention towards someone you can help. They go do it, and everything's fine. All we do is just keep the focus on them and their self-centeredness. That's all we have to do. And it's just absolutely the coolest thing in the world. So if you're new and you haven't taken the steps, get someone that knows how to do it straight out of this book. Get started. If you've been around for a while and you're like me, and you're freaking miserable, and you don't know where to turn, I'm telling you, I don't believe you have to drink again to do this again. I've seen other people do it with 10, 15, 20 years. I don't know if that's anybody in this room. I hope not. But if there is someone in this room that's like that, I would love to talk to you after this meeting. I really would. That's as far as I can go without lying.